relief factor, pain relief that's natural, pain relief that works, and pain relief that attacks the source of the pain. That's the experience of tens of thousands of Americans who are taking Relief Factor right now. See their incredible video endorsements at ReliefFactor.com and then order your three-week quick starter pack for just $19.95. That's less than a dollar a day. Find out if it can work for you like it works for me by ordering your three-week quick starter pack today. ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com. Be the next success story.
If you thought 2016 was important, 2020 is going to be the greatest, most significant election of your lifetime. As a result, we've created a unique additional podcast with our regular guest in studio, former special assistant to President Trump, Boris Epstein. It's called The Battle for 1600. Join us today by subscribing to the podcast for free. Just look for my name, Boris Epstein, and The Battle for 1600.
You're listening to America First with Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Donald J. Trump.
GunBroker.com, the world's largest digital marketplace to buy and sell firearms, ammunition, accessories, and so much more. Gun selection is unmatched at GunBroker.com with over 1 million daily listings. And especially now when ammunition is so hard to find, I guarantee you, you just need to go right now and bookmark GunBroker.com where you are certain to find the gun of your dreams. I have! More than once. Shop at GunBroker.com today. Welcome back, dear friends, to this very, very special edition of America First. I know you're still recovering from the tryptophan, but we want to give you some mental fuel, some food for your mind, given what we have witnessed in just the last 3 weeks in America. One of the key questions that really is not adequately understood is the role of the Electoral College and what our founding fathers did to make sure that this would be, quote, the greatest experiment in democracy. Let's talk to somebody who's literally written the book on the subject. She's back with us. She's Tara Ross. The book is Why We Need the Electoral College. Check it out right now and follow this lady on Twitter at Tara Ross. Tara, welcome back to America First.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Now, I use that quote, that historic quote, that we are the greatest experiment in democracy. But of course, as soon as you say the word democracy, if you're in a room of patriots who understand their history, they say, but we're not a democracy. And they don't mean that we're some kind of authoritarian state. But let's start with the basics. Why are we not a democracy here in America, Tara Ross?
We're not a democracy because the founders were students of history who understood the failures of past democracies and they sought to do something better in their new government. And so they debated the whole summer at the Constitutional Convention and they came up with a product, a constitution, that is actually a blend of democracy with other governmental features such as republicanism, deliberation and compromise in government, federalism, states acting state by state, acting for themselves. And so we have separation of powers between federal and national and the state government.
So let's unpack these words. What does federalism mean? What does republicanism mean? And how does it differentiate us from, for example, where I was born in the UK that has a first past this post electoral system? How does it differentiate us from those countries where, you know, you look at Italy and there's, what, 28 different parties that vie in an election that have governments that last for about 13 months, if that. What is special about the way that this structure is built in America? Well, perhaps let's start here. What are the least understood important aspects of the way America works politically, Tara?
Well, I'll start with the federalism question. It's the idea that states will do things for themselves. And this is because the founders were very, very worried about the prospect of stretching a self-governing nation across such a great diverse territory. If you ask them, they would have said 13 states is way too big and we will not be free because our governance will be so far away from home. And so they wanted to leave some matters at the state level or the local level because they felt that it would be safer that way and that would be more free because you are better able to affect your local governance than to affect your congressman or your senator.
So it's ironically given the left's attempts not only to critique the Electoral College, but to get rid of it. It starts from this comprehension at the beginning, and it's only 13 colonies back then, which by comparison today is nothing. But it is an emphasis on respecting the diversity of these different communities, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially from the founders' perspective, they knew how diverse this country is. I think sometimes we try to pretend like we can fit things into a one-size-fits-all mold. You know, like California and Texas are supposed to agree on what environmental solution is correct. The founders never fooled themselves that way. They knew that that was not possible. They knew the country is too diverse, and they knew that people would end up feeling squashed, like they had no representation in their government. So we, you know, look, we have violated that over and over from my perspective in modern times. And I would argue that that's part of why we're so angry at each other all the time, because we're trying to force each other into agreement when the founders never expected that.
Explain that a little bit. What is this violation? What is it you see people trying to do that is in contravention or in tension with the original founding fathers' vision?
Well, think about the number of things that we try to seek one-size-fits-all solution. Literally anything right now. There's one narrative for pretty much anything, whether it's wear a mask or lockdown or do or don't use this for your, I don't know, to control your environment, or you could go to more other issues like abortion. Or I mean, we're always looking for a one-size-fits-all kind of solution. And that was never, ever intended. I mean, if Texas wants to be more lenient or less lenient in some ways, and California wants to do the opposite, the founders always expected that. They always expected that we would come to different solutions. And that was part of their plan. And it was part of the way that we would be more free, because you could go, your governance would either reflect what you wanted to do, or you could leave and go someplace.
And how did they envisage originally, when we had the colonies, when we were breaking away and then successfully broke away from the most powerful empire at the time, the British Empire? How did the founding fathers look at the role or the intended power of federal government?
Well, if you read the Federalist Papers and you read some of the writings of that time, they're talking about a strong government, but they meant something different by it than what we mean today. What they really meant is you have a guy like George Washington who knew that he could not get food, he could not get payment, he could not get ammunition for his soldiers during the war. So he wanted a government that was strong enough to do those things. And a lot of the founders really did feel like if you're going to give the federal government power to do something like have an army, then you need to make sure that they have full power to do what they've done, but also no power to do anything else. Like, so anything that the federal government has been delegated power to do, it should have full authority to do that. But for everything else, it's left to the states or the people, which is reinforced in our 10th Amendment.
So circumscribing what the powers of federal government are explicitly.
Exactly. People think that the Constitution allows pretty much anything for the federal government to do except for what's explicitly prohibited, but it's actually the opposite. The Constitution only, like, you have to have a delegation of power in the Constitution to do something, otherwise you have no power to do anything at all. But once you have the delegation of power, you do have a lot of power to do what needs to be done.
Talk to us about, we'll examine this in more depth, and we're talking to the author of Why We Need the Electoral College, Tara Ross. Get it right now. We're having these calls by leading politicians to do away with the Electoral College. Have we seen this before? And if we have, has it ever been as vociferous as it is today?
We have seen it before. I'm not sure how to measure the temperature of it. I do know that in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a big uproar about it. A lot of that was driven by the candidacy of George Wallace in the 1968 campaign and how much headway people thought that he had made. I would actually argue it's the opposite. The Electoral College actually constrained him. And even though he obtained a few votes in a certain region, he could not get national appeal. And so he didn't succeed. But that whole series of events did lead to a lot of concern about the Electoral College, and there were hearings in Congress, and They tried to get an amendment passed. One of the most interesting things about that period of time is that some of the most vocal supporters of the Electoral College were actually civil rights leaders who felt that it was protecting the rights of minority Americans to have the Electoral College in place because of the way their vote could be amplified in certain parts of the country. And so it just stands in sharp contrast to what you see today, where people are arguing it's racist or whatever. And actually, in the late 60s and early 70s, they were arguing the complete opposite.
Well, we will unpack that and also answer the question of what would happen to America, the greatest experiment in democracy the world has ever seen, should the Electoral College be abolished. We're talking to Tara Ross. This is America First on the Salem Radio Network. If you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit the notifications bell twice. Hit that like button. It makes a big difference. And also, if you're listening on podcast, write us a little review. If you enjoy the radio show, support those who support us, who make things like America First possible, especially the great Mike Lindell, that American patriot who has sold 51 million of his MyPillows. Why? Because they are that good. I use them, my whole team uses them, the president uses them. The pillow that never gets hot, never loses its shape, just cuddles your cranium through the night, and now he's giving you more than 60% off if you use my name. Not $69.98, $29.98 for one of his amazing pillows. Order two today. Go to mypillow.com, promo code G-O-R-K-A, or call 800-829-8468. That's 800-829-8468, mypillow.com. But you've got to use the secret code G-O-R-K-A. Back after this message.
On the side of the U.S. Constitution, America First.
Collectively, we are recovering from our Thanksgiving stupor as we head into the Christmas season. But for some, that Christmas will not be as it should be. 2.7 million children across this nation who have a mother or father in prison. And Prison Fellowship is helping them get a gift to their children, a Bible and a message of hope. Listen to two of those children share their joy for being part of the Angel Tree program.
Spending time with my family and knowing that my dad cares. He's sending me all these gifts thanks to you. I really like to thank you for it.
I like the presents that my dad sent me. I know that you guys care and he cares. So I just want to thank you for that, and I love Christmas. Thank you, Angel Tree, for doing all that you do, because you don't have to do this, but you choose to do it, and I really appreciate it.
Wow. God bless them, and God bless Prison Fellowship and all of you who have donated to bring a ray of sunshine, a ray of hope to those children who, through no fault of their own, have lost a parent who is now incarcerated. Will you be one of those people who makes a difference? It's just $22 per child to get that Christmas gift, that children's Bible, and that message of hope from their parent behind bars. If you donate $220, that's 10 children whose Christmas you are making better. Be one of those people. Please go to my website, sebgorka.com. That's S-E-B-G-O-R-K-A, sebgorka.com. Click on the Angel Tree banner right at the top and make a donation in any amount. Or call Prison Fellowship at 888-206-2794. That's 888-206-2794. Prison Fellowship, sebgorka.com. God bless you all, and thank you for helping these children. We are back with our special edition. It's our long-form edition today of America First, where we get to sit down with a real expert for a whole hour to talk about matters that are crucial to the understanding of how our nation is so very special. And one of them, so timely, is, of course, the Electoral College. And we have the lady who's written the book, Why We Need the Electoral College. Her name is Tara Ross. Not bad if you get blurbs from Edwin Meese III, the former U.S. Attorney General, on the front cover of your book. Let's dive straight in our second segment, Tara. How does this magical, mystical thing called the Electoral College work. Because, look, I'm an immigrant, and maybe I'm misreading this, but I have a sense that there are millions of Americans who go to that ballot box, fill in the Biden circle or the Trump circle, and they think they're actually voting for the candidate. But they're not, are they?
No, you are not voting for the presidential candidate. We went to the poll several weeks ago, and as you mentioned, that the names of the candidates are on the ballot, but actually you are voting for a slate of presidential electors. You're voting in a statewide election. You're not voting in a national election, a statewide election. I'm in Texas right now. We have 38 electors. So when I went to the polls a couple weeks ago and cast a ballot, it said Joe Biden or Donald Trump, but I was actually saying, no, I either want the Democrat slate of 38 Texans or the Republican slate of 38 Texans, or there were third party slates also. I'm deciding which one I want to cast my ballot for.
Let's stop it, because I want us to not miss a beat. Every state has a designated number of electors. So the Electoral College has the electors. In the state of Texas, there's 38 electors for the presidential election. And when you go and put your name by the Republican or the Democrat candidate or the third party, whatever it is, the question is, who is going to win that 38 number in that state? Is it going to be the Republican slate of electors? Is it going to be the Democrat? Or who knows? Is it going to be the third party, Ross Perot? So you are voting for the representatives of the party in a specific number in that state, correct?
Exactly. Okay. That's exactly what's happening.
And then what happens next? What happens when the numbers are tallied? What is the process? So 3 weeks ago, we have the election. People think they're voting for a candidate, but they're voting for a list of a slate of electors, as it is called. What's the process after that day?
So once the state certifies the election, and it will decide which electors are going to go on to represent the state. Texas either has certified or is close to certifying our slate of electors of 38 Republicans, because the Republicans won the statewide election in Texas. Those Republicans will go on to the meetings of the Electoral College. I said meetings plural because there's actually a different meeting inside every state. There's no central meeting place for the electors. They vote in their state. So in our state, they go to Austin, and the 38 electors will cast the real ballots in the real presidential election. That is the actual presidential election. There's no ballot has been cast in the presidential election until that happens.
So sometime in December, after the state, and usually it's the chief clerk or the secretary of state for that state, certifies, yes, the election happened, yes, this is the result, then the electors of the party that won will meet usually in the state house, and then they vote for their candidate. Let's stop here for a second. What is a faithless elector, Tara Ross?
So a faithless elector is a term that's used for an elector who has decided to vote differently than expected. Usually they're expected to vote for the winner of the popular vote in the state. I just say usually because there were historically a few exceptions to that, as in 1872 when Horace Greeley passed away between the election and the meetings of the electors. But usually you're expected to vote for the winner of the popular vote in your state, and anybody who does something different from that is considered to be a faithless elector.
And 4 years ago, we had this attempt by the Democrats to get the Republican, the Donald Trump slate of electors, vote for Hillary, that they could, you know, that there was Russian collusion or what have you, and you shouldn't vote for the person your party says you should vote for, but you should vote for the other candidate. And then what happens? The vote occurs in the state house or wherever the slate meets. And what happens after that, after December?
So after that point, the electors' votes are sent on to Congress, and Congress will open those votes on January 6th in a joint meeting of the houses, and they will count the votes officially. And if any congressman has an objection to any of the votes, that's their opportunity to say so. But otherwise, they count the votes, and assuming somebody has 270, you go on to, you have your president-elect, and you have an election outcome.
Right. So after the electors have voted in their states, the results of those votes are sent to Washington, D.C. in a joint session of Congress, counts the votes, and whoever gets the magical ceiling or the mandate of 270 electoral college votes becomes the official president-elect. By the way, Mr. Right. Biden, that's when we get our president-elect. However, what happens if there is neither candidate? The scenario where neither candidate reaches 270. We're going to get to that fascinating question because it has happened more than once in our nation's history. And we'll get all the answers from the woman who knows, the author of Why We Need the Electoral College, Tara Ross. I'm Sebastian Gorka. This is America First on the Salem Radio Network on a very, very special day. Stay with us, won't you? The Tunnel to Towers Foundation is marking its season of hope, and they need your help. The foundation is honoring America's heroes by donating 36 homes in 36 days. That's one home a day from Thanksgiving through New Year's Eve. Tunnel to Towers is gifting homes in more than two dozen states across our nation. They're bringing hope to great Americans, our catastrophically injured veterans, Gold Star, and fallen first responder families. The foundation is giving thanks to all of those who have sacrificed so much for us, and to the many people like you across this country who have supported their efforts to honor our nation's heroes. Join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good. Donate $11 a month by going to t2t.org. That's T, the number 2, T.org. T2T.org. Help bring hope to America's heroes and their families. Thank you.
Portions of America First are brought to you by GunBroker.com.
It is an incredible system. It was built by those who knew that mob rule isn't a good thing. Why? Because 51% of the population can win an election and then trample on the rights, desires, and wishes of the 49% that lost. Not a good idea. We're unpacking the reality of the Electoral College by the author of Why We Need the Electoral College, Tara Ross. Follow her right now on Twitter at Tara Ross. Tara, we were halfway through explaining the functioning of the Electoral College more than once in our history. First things first, why 270? Where does that come from?
Good question. It's the number of congressmen, basically. So every state has the same number of electors as they have members of the House of Representatives and also your two United States senators. Plus, there are three electors for Washington, D.C.
Right. And what happens should the Electoral College vote not provide that 270 to any of the candidates, especially if there's three candidates?
So it hasn't happened since 1824. Although I've been joking, that would be just a very 2020 thing to do, right? To put us in a situation. But if we were to be in a situation where nobody had 270 electors, the election of the president moves on to the House of Representatives. The election of the vice president moves on to the Senate. In the House of Representatives, each state delegation has one vote. So California with its 53 congressmen or Rhode Island with its two congressmen, both have one vote each. And it would take a majority of 26 states to win the presidency. The House is allowed to choose from the top three vote getters. Now, the Senate, on the other hand, can choose from the top two vote getters, and each senator gets one vote. It takes the majority of senators to win.
And should it have occurred in 2020, if that is the scenario, why would the current incumbent have an advantage when it comes to the House picking the president if it is a state delegation?
Well, I don't think the incumbent has an advantage, probably. It's just whoever has the most state delegations. And I haven't even counted. I don't know the answer, whether Republicans or Democrats.
Well, the Republicans do. The Republicans outnumber the Democrats by six. So that's why it would be
State delegations?
Yeah, by state delegations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a scenario whereby President Donald Trump could win. Talk to us about why. What is the dynamic of how the Electoral College makes sure that we don't have a preponderance of large conurbations, large cities deciding who the president is?
Well, look, historically speaking, the best way to win the Electoral College is to build coalitions that span regions, that span states, that span different types of voters. And historically, those kinds of candidates that fail to do that are penalized. So we could look at 2016, but a less emotional example is 1888, because nobody has feelings about Grover Cleveland losing that election that year. But in 1888, Grover Cleveland had an over-reliance on six southern states. He won 72% of the vote in those states, and he won the national popular vote, but he lost the Electoral College because Benjamin Harrison did a much better job of spreading out his base of appeal across other parts of the country. And he tended to have smaller margins where he was winning, but he had also more broad-based appeal. And so that's why he won the Electoral College. And I would argue that was a good outcome. We don't want six southern states to choose the president for the whole rest of the United States.
So
in 2016,
go ahead.
I was saying in 2016, which of course is closer to home, and we're still have emotions about that. But in 2016, the reason that Hillary Clinton failed to win the Electoral College is because she got most of her support from very similar types of voters who tend to live in large cities. She got 20% of her vote from only California and New York, and in those states, most of her support came from the big cities. Now, if that strategy had been rewarded, you can imagine that both the Democratic and the Republican Party would have doubled down on that kind of behavior this year. You would have seen Democrats running to Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, giving them what they want, you know, appealing to whatever they makes them happy. And you would have seen Republicans running to Houston and Dallas and giving the oil interests everything they want. And we don't want that kind of an atmosphere. We want more inclusive attitudes from our candidates.
There is a reason why a senator from New York or a billionaire from Manhattan, they go to Wisconsin, they go to Iowa, they go to New Hampshire, because they have to build that base across the nation. That is the genius of the Electoral College. More with the expert who wrote the book, Why We Need the Electoral College, Tara Ross, here on this special edition of America First on the Salem Radio Network with me, Sebastian Gorka, member of the President's National Security Education Board. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, don't touch that dial.
This is Second Amendment Friday on America First, brought to you by GunBroker.com.
GunBroker.com helps us every Friday celebrate the Second Amendment. We are delighted to be collaborating with my favorite gun site on the planet. GunBroker.com makes it so easy to visit one page to buy all the guns and accessories you need. Ammunition, too. If you're a gun enthusiast, a hunter, a sportsman, just a collector, bookmark gunbroker.com and visit it at least once a day or more. Right now, I found this incredible Blaser R8 straight pull action rifle. It's called the Baroness. What a great name. 257 Weatherby Magnum. Oh, wow, that is a remarkable weapon. I'm going to keep my eyes on that that auction. We are so excited to have our title sponsor for this hour be GunBroker.com. Celebrate the Second Amendment with me by going to GunBroker.com today and every day to discover the perfect deal for you. We are in the midst of a turbulent season. We have to understand what the founding fathers bequeathed to us, this incredible system that we call the Electoral College. We don't vote for specific candidates. We vote for a slate of electors, and we have to understand how that system works. The person who wrote the book is Tara Ross, Why We Need the Electoral College. Speak to us, if you will, Tara. What would happen? Just describe a potential future if there was no electoral college in the United States.
You know, maybe I'll start by quoting John F. Kennedy, who said, "We have a solar system of governmental power, and you can't expect to change one aspect of the solar system without changing everything else." He was speaking in defense of the Electoral College as a United States Senator on the Senate floor. So what I would say to add to that is you can't expect to make this decision in a vacuum. There will be many changes, many of which are going to be unanticipated. I think some of those will include things like we've already talked about candidates running to the big cities just to gather as much support as they can there. But I think another thing that will fall apart is our stable two-party system. And people don't really think about that, and maybe people even don't want the two-party system, but it's not enough to be upset with where you are. You have to think about where you're going to go. And if we don't have a stable two-party system, what we will have is a multi-party, fractured, divided America. You can imagine us having elections that look much like the ones in France, where they literally have 6 to 10 candidates running for the presidency. Somebody gets 19% and 18% of the vote, and they land in a runoff. And then the French people are expected to choose from between two candidates who were rejected by 80% of the country. That is not a system that promotes coalition building and working together and all of the sorts of things that we take for granted right now. So I do think that would be one thing. But the last thing I would say is fraud would become much easier than we would want. Now, I'm not suggesting we have a perfect system now. We're all in a big mess right this year. But we have a system that enables us to isolate our problems to one or a handful of states, and we can watch those areas more closely. It's easier to be on defense in a handful of areas than to try to be on defense in every single precinct of the country. But you can imagine what would happen this year with a national recount, allegations of fraud, whatever, nationwide. And instead, we're just dealing with a handful of states. Let's figure this out and move on to a certain election outcome.
That's an intriguing point. Can you explain to us why it is that we're focusing explicitly on a handful of states? Is it because those states have the biggest number of electors, or is it because of the margins in the other states? You're right. We do tend to focus on half a dozen states. Why is that?
Well, as far as this situation is concerned, historically, what I would say is you land in a situation like this when the national total, the electoral total, is very close. Okay, close enough that just swinging one or two states is going to make a difference. And then also simultaneously, you need to have close margins in those states or some kind of dispute in those states so that swinging those states will make a difference to the outcome. Historically, that doesn't happen that often. It's happening right now. It happened in 1876 and 2000, but it's not usually something that happens. Usually either the national margin is wide or the states don't line up with what you need or that sort of thing.
And what would it take? Because, no, this isn't some fringe element. These aren't, you know, blog posters saying get rid of the Electoral College. These are people who are the face of one of the parties saying we need to get rid of it. What would it take? Is it a Congress of states? How would that occur, Tara?
Well, what's supposed to happen to get rid of the Electoral College is that Congress would propose an amendment, and then the states would have to also ratify that. It would take 2/3 of the Congress and 3/4 of the states. Now, so that's what's supposed to happen because there is another idea out there where states are trying to sign a compact, an interstate compact, to try to get rid of it that way. But there's constitutional problems with that compact, and it will get fought out in court.
So they would try to go around that requirement with just state-by-state agreements? Would that not butt up against the Constitution?
So the idea that they had is everybody signs a contract, and by the terms of the contract, they say any state that has signed the contract agrees to give all of its electors to the winner of the national popular vote. So right now, 15 states plus Washington, D.C. have signed this contract. That's 196 electors. It goes into effect when 270 electors are committed to the plan. So, of course, when the state legislatures all start meeting in January, this will come up again. They're going to try states like Virginia or Nevada or some places like this that they haven't gotten yet. And when that happens, if they get to 270, we will find this in front of the Supreme Court is what will happen.
And what do you think happens then? What is the constitutional requirement that, buttresses up against that plan?
Well, I always hope the court will do the right thing. But if the way I see it is that states do have great discretion in how they allocate their electors, which is why this contract idea came into place in the first place. However, the states do not have so much discretion that they can violate another portion of the Constitution in the process. So if Texas were to say, we're going to hold an election for presidential elector, but only men get to vote, that would be wrong because it would be a violation of the 19th Amendment. So I would argue that no state can allocate its electors in a way that violates Article 5 of the Constitution.
Wow. They're working hard. They don't like it. I think we know why. We are getting an education on the Electoral College by the author of Why We Need the Electoral College. Follow her on Twitter at Tara Ross. This is a special edition of America First with me, your host, Sebastian Gorka.
Portions of today's program are brought to you by Prison Fellowship.
Just one short video she recorded for Prager University has had more than 50 million views. That's because she knows of what she speaks. She is the author of Why We Need the Electoral College, Tara Ross. Get it now and also follow her on Twitter at Tara Ross. Tara, let's end with perhaps the most important question. Given these attempts, these compacts, these voices who want to do away with this ingenious construct, the Electoral College, who would suffer the most if the Electoral College were done away with in America?
Well, honestly, my instinctive answer is all Americans, because it serves all of us. But I think some of the felt needs that would come out immediately are small states, rural areas. I think I mentioned earlier that civil rights leaders in the 70s were fighting for this institution. I think it would hurt minority groups. I don't think people expect that, but it really would. It serves all of us by allowing, it creates a system where all voices can be heard and can be have representation in the presidency of the United States. The president is the only office in this country that is expected to represent every single American, whether you're a lobster fisherman in Maine or an oil person in Texas, or you're fighting for environmental causes in California. This is the guy that's expected to represent you. And there's no other office that you can say that about.
You've studied this all your life. Have you ever seen a system anywhere else as ingenious as the Electoral College here in America?
No. But, you know, it was created at a unique moment in time. We could not possibly hope to replicate that. The founders did not have political parties. There was none of that kind of partisan interest existing in 1787. To the degree they had a bias, it was a bias in favor of their state, which tended to express itself as a large versus small state bias, which I would argue has helped us.
Truly, truly remarkable what those dead white heterosexual men managed to come up with more than two centuries ago, and it is still serving us well. We've been talking to Tara Ross, the author of Why We Need the Electoral College, also the star of one of Dennis Prager's most successful PragerU videos. Go and check it out right now and follow her on Twitter at Tara Ross. This is a special edition of America First on the Salem Radio Network, coming to you from the ReliefFactor.com studios just outside the insalubrious swamp that is Washington, D.C. If you are watching this on YouTube, please hit the like button. If it just popped up on your feed, then make sure to subscribe. Hit the notifications bell twice and you'll never miss a thing. Our YouTube channel is on fire. And you will find all of our segments, our guests, our best monologues right there. In the meantime, stay tuned right here to America First with me, Sebastian Gorka.